insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
We are back, and thanks again for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thanks for listening to Relevant Radio. Wherever you are in the world, thank you for that. Please tell your friends, tell them all about the Relevant Radio app. It's free. Anyone, anywhere in the world with an internet connection can listen to this program and all of our other programs. So please help spread the word about Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. My number is 888-914-9149. That number is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, 888-914-9149. We're going to go to the phones in a moment. First, though, all joking aside, no levity or joking or anything like that, a completely serious note. I can't say I'm reading this book. It's through Audible. Audible is a great little resource. You have so many countless books that are available in the spoken word format. And the app is free. I have no connection with them. I don't make any money or have any, you know, benefit to me. But I must say I'm really gripped by a book that I only found out about a couple of days ago. I was reading some news reportage about the danger of what's going on with Russia and NATO and the danger of war and the way in which things could easily get out of control. And of course, I'm thinking too about like the Fatima prophecies from Our Lady back in 1917, and Russia will spread her errors and certain nations will be annihilated. Very, very stringent predictions. I don't know if stringent is the right word for it, but hair-raising predictions. The Divine Mercy Diary is replete with warnings about problems that could arise if people don't pray and ask the Lord for mercy, etc. That's, of course, the whole point of the Divine Mercy devotion. Or Akita in Japan. And that took place in, it began at least, the apparitions that were approved locally by the bishop at the time in Akita, Japan, warnings about terrible punishments and fire falling from the sky and people dying, etc. So I don't say any of those things to bring you down, but I mean, Our Lady came here to tell us some of those things, Fatima, for example. So if it's good enough for her to tell us, I suppose it's okay for me to mention it in passing. But anyway, I'm reading some of these articles about the precariousness that we don't really fully appreciate. I don't think I ever did really appreciate just how precarious things can be when it comes to one false move, one misunderstanding, one hot-headed renegade person, how easily and how utterly devastating war would be. We're seeing a little sort of microcosm of war in Gaza between Hamas and Israel. We're seeing a little sort of microcosm of war, and certainly a conventional war at that, in Ukraine. And there are other hotspots around the world. So those are some that we see on a regular basis in the news and whatnot. But I'm here to tell you, they mentioned a book by Annie Jacobson. The book itself is not even out yet. I went to Amazon to order this book on the strength of some of the things that I was reading. The book is called Nuclear War, A Scenario. Nuclear War, subtitle, A Scenario. The author's name is Annie Jacobson. And I'm not quite at the halfway point. I started to listen. I downloaded the book on Audible. So I've been listening to it for the better part of, I don't know, 2 days, 2.5 days. This is really eye-opening. Now, the whole point of the book is she draws upon just voluminous interviews with high-level people. At the very beginning of the book, for example, and it takes maybe 3 or 4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, I don't know. I kind of skipped to the end of it. But she says the sources that she used for the information she's going to share in this book, and then she just goes through and lists this who's who of high-level scientists, prominent people in the government, and by them I'm referring to people who, you know, have some connection to nuclear weapons, people in the military, scientists. It's an amazing panoply of people with amazing expertise in this field. And she did this research and interviews, and she quotes them liberally throughout the book. But it really got my attention because it's not like Tom Clancy sat down and decided to write a novel about what would it be like if a war happened. And Tom Clancy was well-informed, it seems to me, because he wrote very vivid books about such things. But this is not that kind of a book. This is where she draws upon the things that these people are saying, unclassified documents that are available, etc. Now, there's much that goes beyond this that is classified that, of course, she can't talk about. She doesn't even know. But if you ever want to get a better appreciation for why it's so important to pray for peace, this book will be out sometime soon. Read it or listen to it on Audible. And I'm not trying to sell a book to you. I have no connection to this whatsoever, but I'm just sharing with you something personal that's on my mind, because we hear all the time, pray for peace and let's pray for peace. And at the, you know, the prayers of the faithful at Mass, you know, let us pray for peace in the world. It's just kind of a slogan for most people. It's just kind of a happy thought. Wouldn't it be nice if we had peace? I'm telling you, if you listen to or read this book, you will gain a whole new order of magnitude of appreciation for why you want to pray for peace. And pray as hard as you can for not just peace among nations, but for the, you know, the mental stability of people like Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden and Kim Jong-il and, you know, all the various figures around the world who are in one way or another capable of initiating what would result in a nuclear conflict. And if you, for no other reason, were to read this book, you're going to find out in painstaking detail what happens when a nuclear bomb goes off. And that's all I want to say about it, because, I mean, I'm not finished with the book yet, but I'm avidly working my way through it. I expect to be finished in the next day or two. But it's been on my mind, quite frankly. I haven't mentioned it to you, Cyrus, but it's been on my mind, given all the, you know, things going on in the world and how easy it is for us to talk about peace and let's pray for peace and wouldn't it be nice to have peace, etc. This book will give you a whole new incentive to beg the Lord for peace.
What's the name of it again?
Nuclear War, a Scenario. And it's fiction, but it's not fiction. I mean, it's fiction based upon this intense research. So what she's doing is saying, okay, based on all of this information and everything that we know from history and what we can know that's not been, you know, that has been declassified, here's what would happen. Here's how it could go down. And I don't want to give anything away, because it's worth just letting it unfold for yourself. But I know you're a peaceful guy, Cyrus, and you like peace and you want peace. I'm telling you, you'll have a whole new appreciation for why we want peace if you read this book.
Yeah, thanks. I wish it wasn't necessary.
Same here. But, you know, I like to share stuff from my own life, and so much of the show is just like me reacting to, you know, you callers, you call in and you ask a question or you look for an opinion or something. And I'm reacting to you, which is good. And that's, I enjoy doing that. And I hope you enjoy it too. But I'm sharing something from my life with you that you can, at the very least, you know, just be thinking about why it's so important to pray for peace. This is a secular book. It's not religious. It has nothing to do with religion or anything like that. But if you, like I, want to live, as the Bible says, if you want to live a quiet and tranquil life in all devotion and dignity, war will stop that right away. So I don't want to overemphasize it, but it has been on my mind, and I'm glad I have an opportunity to share the title of the book with you, just in case you're interested. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Therese now in Milwaukee. Good morning, Therese.
Hi, I have a question for my 3.5-year-old.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how to answer it in an age-appropriate way. She asked me, in her words, why does God create souls one at a time and not all at once?
You know, that's a really good question. I think the answer is pretty simple, though. So in the case of angels, the church teaches that God created all the angels all at once. And how many there were, we don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us, and apostolic tradition doesn't tell us. But we can surmise that it must be many, many billions or even trillions, or maybe higher than that. We just don't know. But the reason that God would create all the angels all at once is because angels don't have bodies and they don't reproduce. So there's no generation in angels. There are no, you know, parents, grandparents, etc. So there's no need for them not to be created all at once. And it's not as though God every so often might need a few extra angels to take care of things, so he pops out a few new angels or anything like that. But human beings are different because we procreate. And so the nature of procreation in time and space is you have generation and you have generations. So you can talk to your daughter and say, it's a daughter, I think, right? Your 3-year-old?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
So you can say, you know how you have grandparents and you have great-grandparents? Well, they had great-grandparents and so on. So you could say the reason God doesn't create human beings all at once is because when you're created, like you're 3 years old now, well, when you grow up, you will get married and you will have children. And that's when God creates those souls, because he's waiting for you to grow up and for you to get married. And then when you start having children, that's when God creates them. Just like you could tell her, when I was a little girl, you weren't created yet, because I needed to grow up and meet daddy, and we got married, and eventually we started having children. That's when God created you. I think for a 3-year-old, that's probably about as much as she can accommodate. But that's really the true answer right there. It's mm-hmm. that we procreate, and over time, in other words, if God created who knows how many billions of human beings have ever existed and how many exist now and how many ever will exist, let's say it's 50 billion human beings, might be more than that. Well, if there were 50 billion human beings all born at the same time, who's going to change those diapers? Who's gonna feed all those babies? You know, it would be an impossibility, because we're humans and we grow and we procreate. But in your own motherly way, if you can sort of bring that down to your daughter's level, I think she would understand it, don't you?
Well, I guess I offered a similar explanation, and she said, "Mommy, I understand that. I understand that everyone has to be born and everyone has to die, but why can't we all be born at the same time and live at the same time and die at the same time so that we never have to be apart?"
Oh, what a sweet sentiment. And she's not thinking about, you know, what the complications would be. Let's say that, well, maybe you could share that with her and just say, well, let's say that if God created all of us at the same time, because there are other questions, who would we all be born from? No, there'd be nobody before us if we were all created all at the same time. There'd be no way to be born from your mom, because there would be no mom if we were all created at the same time. So you could explain perhaps that the way God creates human beings is that he creates the soul at the moment that the baby starts existing in mommy's tummy. At that same moment, that's when you come into existence. And that's the way human beings come into existence. So if we were all created at the same time, there would be no mommy there. There'd be no one to be born from. That's kind of deep, but maybe she can understand that.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful.
It is an interesting conversation, no doubt.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Nice chatting with you, Therese, and thank you for the call. 888-914-9149. How about Mark now in Turlock, California? Hello, Mark.
Hi, Patrick. I have a couple of questions. A friend of mine and I have been going back and forth about transgender issues and just debating on through text. And something that he mentioned to me, I asked him if he could define male and female, and he said that he couldn't, and that he doesn't think that the church does either. And I wanted to see if you could refute that point and help me out and what how to respond to that. I think he was thinking that there are, like in Genesis, when God created male and female, he said that that's before the fall of man, and that the fall of man happened, and because of that, other developments occurred. So,
okay. All right, let's take it from there.
That was his first point.
So he rejects the categories then, right? He doesn't believe that the binary exists, that it's male and female. Is that the essence of his argument?
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's where that he's confused by it, because there are men that can have a lot of feminine traits and vice versa. And so it's he believes in probably biological realities, but he thinks the psychological is really important too, and that can define who a person is as well.
Okay. So let's start there. The starting point for me would be when Jesus himself alludes to what you just mentioned from the book of Genesis. So in Matthew 19, in verse 4, he says, "Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female?" So Jesus invokes the binary. He invokes these two categories of male and female. And then after invoking it, in the next verse, verse 5, he says, "For this reason," and now he instantiates these categories. He says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, a woman, and the two shall become one flesh." So he not only acknowledges or invokes the paradigm of male and female, but now he's bringing it into the present and saying, this is why nowadays, here and now, you see a man marry a woman and the two become one flesh. So even though this is not a lengthy Bible verse, it nonetheless, it shows that this is something Jesus as God is invoking long after the fall of Adam and Eve. So it's not as though there were male and female before the fall, and then because of man's sin, suddenly now you've got this vast variety of what the other permutations might be. It's still the same now as it was then, as Jesus said in his day, it was still male and female. So I recognize that this is, you might say, the crux of the problem, because there's no way for the people who hold those views to win the argument on the basis of science and physiology and chromosomes and things like that. I mean, it's just as clear as can be that there is male and female. So they're fighting the battle on this other sort of imaginary front, which is detached from reality and science and evidence, and it's in the realm of feelings and your own subjective view of yourself. And in my experience, Mark, one way to help him see that that is not a trustworthy matrix to measure what is real and what isn't real would be to use the example of a girl with anorexia. And to say, and, you know, this is a not uncommon eating disorder in which the girl, I've never really heard of boys having anorexia. Perhaps there are somewhere, but I haven't heard about that. So let's just say the prototypical girl with anorexia. She objectively, she can step on the scale and see that she weighs 95 pounds or 90 or 100 pounds or whatever, something underweight. So you can present her with the data to say, look in the mirror, you're emaciated. The scale doesn't lie. You weigh X number of pounds and that's underweight. It's unhealthy, et cetera, et cetera. But in her mind, she perceives herself as being overweight. And therefore, she, you know, does the harmful activities, whether it's binging and purging or just not eating or whatever it may be in a given case, in which her perception of herself is wrong. Her perception of herself is detached from reality. And perhaps you could ask your friend, what would be the appropriate and right and ethical thing to do if you're the father of a 14 or 15-year-old girl who has anorexia? Would it be the ethical and right thing to do to say, oh, okay, well, if that's how you feel, sure, okay, no more food, and you would, in essence, enable her to die by starving herself to death over time? Or would it be the ethical and right thing to do to say, oh, honey, I know you feel that way, but you're not overweight. You're seriously underweight. We need to get you some help so that you can overcome this misunderstanding, this distorted view of yourself. Your view of yourself and what you think of yourself isn't true. It's not real. And I know you feel strongly about this, and I love you as much as I ever have loved you. And because I love you, I want you to get some help so that you can overcome this distorted perception of yourself. I suspect that if your friend is clear thinking and at least intellectually honest enough to not look away from the truth, he's going to agree with you. He's going to say, you know, it would be the right thing to do. So then what you do is you say, what is the difference between that example in which she has in her own mind a perception of herself that's not real? It doesn't comport with reality and the evidence. What's the difference in that case compared to somebody who is objectively male but who feels like he's female? So that's one way you can approach it. And then lastly, and I'll throw it back to you. I'm overdue for a break, Mark, so I'll leave it at this. The other thing I would point out is inherent in his own argument is a kind of refutation of his argument. If there is no actual male or female, then there can be no such thing as female characteristics. So if a man acts more like a woman, he's more effeminate, he's more whatever, that in itself it can't even exist, because if there is no such thing as a woman, then there can't be so-called feminine characteristics that a man might have. To the extent that a man is effeminate and has feminine characteristics, he's acting like a woman. He's not a woman, but he's acting like a woman, and that would be impossible if there is no such thing as a woman. And I'm overdue for a break, but I hope that's helpful to you, Mark. Yes, everybody. I know you don't have to email me. I know Matt Walsh came out with an excellent movie called What is a Woman? I saw it. I saw it before you saw it because I got a pre-screener, and it's good. What is a Woman? That's something you might want to check out. I'll be right back. Let a woman be a woman. Let a man be a man. Listen. Gotta let a woman be a woman. Let a man be a man. Gotta let a woman be a woman. Let a man be a man. But listen. This hour is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Join the nation's largest Catholic-oriented credit union and receive $200 when you add a direct deposit. Learn more at NotreDameFCU.com/join. That's NotreDameFCU.com/join.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
I just want to let that get out there. I got a note a moment ago from Gary, and here's his one-line question. Has the Pope commented on Biden's Visibility Day on Easter Sunday? If not, why not? Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for writing to me, Gary. How on earth could I know? I mean, I'm not aware that the Pope has said anything about that. If he has, it hasn't been reported, at least not in my field of vision. I haven't seen anything. But the last part of your question, I'm not really sure what to make of it. You know, if not, why? How would I know? I mean, I'm pretty sure he's a busy guy. I'm pretty sure he's got a lot of things going on. And of course, even though we here in the United States, we have a tendency to think in terms of what's going on here in the United States is everybody's thinking about what's going on here, what people are saying here, but the whole rest of the world is doing its thing. And if you're the Pope, I mean, you're kind of like a global pastor in a way. So if not, why not? How would I know, Gary? How could anyone know? But I appreciate the question. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Peter waiting patiently in Staten Island. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, Patrick. I have a quick question. We had gone to Holy Thursday Mass, and what happened was after the homily, they skipped the washing of the feet. We just thought it was all odd. Everybody, you know, was looking at each other. I emailed the pastor, you know, the next day saying, why was this left out? And he mailed me an article from EWTN from 2011 saying basically you can. And he says, you know, Father omitted it as per his, you know, prerogative. And I just was taken aback by that. In all the years that we've attended this Mass, for the last 30 years in this parish, there's always been washing of the feet. We see the Pope do it at 87 from a wheelchair, you know, in a prison. And I just felt very, taken aback. I just want to know, you know, your thoughts. Maybe I'm making too much of this.
Well,
like what you felt about it.
Mm-hmm. I can understand where you're coming from, but I kind of think you might be making too big of a deal out of this. And here's why. There are some things that the priest has the option of omitting or including. And although I haven't looked at what the general instruction says on Holy Thursday Mass, let's just assume, based upon what you said, that that's the case, that it is at his discretion. He can either include it or omit it. Well, in that case, and I don't think there's anything to be up in arms about, but naturally I understand that if you really like that being present in the Mass, and of course it has tremendous meaning, it's a very powerful thing, it comes straight from Scripture, all of those things, I could easily understand why for you it's a sort of a loss. You know, you would rather that it be there than not be there. I understand that, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But that's where I'm saying it's possible that you are making too much out of it, because if the church says that the priest has, at his discretion, the ability to omit a certain thing in Mass, even though it may be customary, but he can still omit that, and he does omit it, you can be crestfallen or disappointed, but I wouldn't go to war over it, or I wouldn't turn it into something bigger than it needs to be, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Just that we're so used to it, you know, all different pastors in the parish, it was never omitted, and it just struck me funny. But I totally, you know, understand. Just want to know your take. You know, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I really enjoyed the show.
You're most Perfect. Welcome. I thank you for that, Peter. And as I say, I would need to go back and just double check to make sure. But it sounds like what you heard, or what you were told, is the correct answer. But when those kind of arcane, specific details about the Mass, is this permitted, is that permitted, it's always better, for me at least, to go back and double check it to make sure, so I don't give erroneous information.
Right, right. Okay. Patrick, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Nice chatting with you. Happy Easter, by the way. 888-914-9149. How about 9-year-old Marilyn in Racine, Wisconsin. Is that right? You're 9 years old, Marilyn?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, it's nice to talk to you. What's your question for me?
How do sisters turn into mothers in the convent?
So, I mean, when they have the title, like Mother, you know, Mother Mary Agnes or Mother Teresa Marie or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. The way that happens is the sisters in the convent, they vote every so many years. Could be every 5 or 6 years, every 3 years. They have their own rules. And depending upon their rule, they will get together, let's say every 5 years, and they vote on who will be the sister in the convent, who will be the mother of the order. It could be called the Mother General or the Mother Superior. There are different terms, but she would be like the one in charge. And they vote. And the next time it comes to a vote, maybe they're going to vote that the same sister will stay in that office. Or maybe she won't want to continue because she's old or she's tired or, you know, could be some reason. And they might vote for a different nun to become the mother. So that's how it happens. They vote every so many years. And then she gets that title. Does that help you?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm interested in your thinking about this. Do you And your family knows some sisters in the convent?
No.
Mm. Well, I'll bet that somewhere in Racine, Wisconsin, there must be a convent of sisters, and maybe at some point you'll get to meet some of them. Have you ever thought about being a sister when you grow up?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Well, ask God to show you if that's what he wants you to do. He'll show you.
All right.
Okay. Hey, by the way, you could tell your mom that there are a lot of different religious sisters, and one group of them that I know are Carmelite sisters. They're in Los Angeles, Southern California, if you know where that is. And they have some beautiful videos of them singing. And if you were to look them up, I think your mom might be listening right now. So it's the Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart of Los Angeles. And on their website, the Carmelite Sisters OCD. Cyrus, can you check that website for me? So it's the Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart of Los Angeles. And I'll give you the website, but they have some videos of them so you can see what they look like and you can see how they dress and you can see them singing. And that might be something interesting for you to look at as you think about this question. Sound good, Marilyn?
Yeah.
Okay. Is your mom listening right now?
No.
Oh.
I could tell her.
Okay. Well, can you remember this? Carmelite Sisters OCD. You probably can't remember that, can you? I probably couldn't remember that. CarmeliteSistersOCD.com. So before we have to go, did you have another question or was that it?
That's it.
Okay. So tell your mom that she can listen. Okay.
Actually, we have another question.
Okay, let's do it.
How does a deacon become a priest?
Performs a prayer as the altar boy.
How does a deacon become a priest? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So a deacon is ordained a deacon by the bishop. You've heard of the sacrament of holy orders, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the first level of the sacrament of holy orders. There are three levels. And the lowest level is the diaconate, the deacon. And then if the bishop wants that deacon to become a priest, and a man who's studying to be a priest, he's ordained a deacon first. And then usually a few months or a year maybe as a deacon, it depends on where he is, then the bishop ordains him to the priesthood. And that's and he receives the sacrament of holy orders again in the next highest level. So he's ordained from being a deacon to being a priest. And most priests stay at that level. And every so often, the church will choose some of the priests to become bishops. And then they receive the sacrament of holy orders again, but at the highest level, the level of bishop. So that's how a deacon becomes a priest, when the bishop ordains him to the priesthood in the sacrament. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm really glad we could talk, Marilyn. Happy Easter to you and your family. Okay. Thank you. I think at that age, Cyrus, kids haven't quite yet figured out how you can't see them nodding their heads or answering that way.
Yeah, they're waving. You say hello and they wave at the phone.
Right. Well, it is nice. Those little lambs out there. Hey, ladies, if you're thinking about a religious vocation, there are many good, worthy groups of religious sisters, no doubt. One that I am very familiar with and for many, many years have been close to, Nancy and I, would be those Carmelite Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart of Los Angeles. Their website is CarmeliteSistersOCD.com. OCD stands for Order of Discalced Carmelites. Discalced means, you know, you don't wear shoes. They do wear shoes, but that's the type of Carmelite they are. CarmeliteSistersOCD.com. They're in Southern California. And if ever you were looking for a really powerful retreat experience. They do retreats nonstop at their retreat house in Southern California. So you can check that out too. CarmeliteSistersOCD.com. I'll be right back. Big time gratitude to Charity Mobile for sponsoring the Patrick Madrid Show. They're a pro-life cell phone company with nationwide coverage and no contracts. You can choose from the latest phones or bring your own. New customers can mention Patrick for a free phone or another offer. Info at charitymobile.com.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You may remember on Monday, I believe it was, I briefly mentioned a story about how the White House policy for the Easter egg hunt and the contest for the Easter egg, I don't know, poster or whatever the kids would make, included a prohibition of anything religious. And so I just want to give a hat tip of thanks to, who's the person who sent this to me? This is from Miguel. And he pointed out something I wasn't aware of. I did mention this story, but apparently it's being retracted by a few people, and I'd like to mention that. And this is from The Hill. White House thanks Daily Caller for retracting story on religious Easter egg ban. The White House expressed appreciation for the Daily Caller on Tuesday after the conservative outlet retracted a post that implied the Biden administration had instituted a new ban on religious symbols on Easter eggs during its annual holiday celebration. Corinne Jean-Pierre told reporters, she's the White House press secretary, it's important to acknowledge when a mistake has been made and take responsibility for it. So I want to recognize the Daily Caller for having the integrity to retract their story about the false claims circulating about the Easter egg roll. The Daily Caller published an article saying that the White House had banned children from submitting Easter eggs with religious themes. But they point out that this has been for some time now, decades even, part of the rules for this little project for the kids. So thank you, Miguel, for pointing that out to me. And I'm happy to follow suit and say, even though I mentioned it briefly, turns out, as a certain radio announcer used to say, there's the rest of the story. And there you have it. Let's go to Colin now in Georgetown, Texas. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yeah.
I had a quick question about John chapter 18. I was thinking about this after the Good Friday reading.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering when Pilate kind of just asked the open-ended question of what is truth,
mm-hmm.
It just seems like kind of a cliffhanger there. And if there's any significance to that question.
The question of Pilate, you mean? What is truth?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so he's having his conversation with Pilate, and Pilate is bewildered. You know, he doesn't understand why is Jesus not responding at first, and why is he not doing anything to exonerate himself? Why is he, you know, not doing what you would expect an ordinary person to do who's in that situation? And so in verse 37, Pilate says, "So you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I have come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." So then Pilate, verse 38, says, "What is truth?" After he had said this, he went out to the Jews again and told them, "I find no crime in him." So my reading of this story, Colin, or this incident rather, is that Jesus was revealing something to him that he didn't understand, and he didn't really understand the import of this, because Jesus says elsewhere, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And so Pilate didn't realize that he's speaking to truth himself, Jesus as the truth. And so not only is he confused by this, you know, counterintuitive kind of behavior of Jesus, not trying to get out of this terrible situation, but he also is confused by, you know, well, what do you mean the truth? What is truth? What are you talking about? What truth is this that you're referring to? And then, as you say, just sort of stops there. I think it's because he didn't know what to make of it, and Jesus didn't say anything further. So he goes back out to the crowd.
Okay, that makes sense.
In my mind, I always thought
maybe there was more, maybe Jesus answered that question, but maybe it was just left open-ended.
Well, if he answers it, we don't know what the answer was. It's not reported to us in the Gospels what the answer was. So all we know from the biblical account is what is said there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Patrick.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad I could be of service. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Wayne now in Chicago. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Patrick. I was listening to you when you were talking about what is a woman, and I just wanted to make a point. Ka'Jari Jackson Brown isn't one of my favorite justices, but when she was asked that question, what is a woman, her answer was, I can't answer that. I'm not a biologist.
And I remember that.
Yeah. And the way I took that was she was saying very clearly that it's biology that determines who a man and a woman are. But as a legal person, she was not qualified to give a scientific biological answer to the question. So I'm really glad that Matt Walsh did that story. It was terrifying but important. But mm-hmm. The point is, I think Ka'Jari Brown actually said it's biology that determines who a woman is.
Well, she didn't say that exactly. So this is the hearing leading up to her confirmation.
Right.
And now here, there's some important context to keep in mind here, and that is that Joe Biden, he said, I am not going to nominate a candidate to fill this seat on the Supreme Court who is not a woman. So that's the backstory, that she was there because she's a woman. In other words, because he right. wasn't going to okay. nominate a man. So that was the irony of the question, is that here she is, a woman candidate nominee, for that position, and she refused to take the bait. She knew what they were doing. Whoever it was that asked her the question, I forget who it was. She clearly, and she's an intelligent woman, she understood where this was going, and that's why in this lame, clumsy, transparently obvious sort of way, she declined to identify what a woman is, because she knew that if she did, it would undercut this whole transgender ideology that she's at least ostensibly not opposed to. So that's why it was so strange and awkward and even comical, because she clearly, everybody knows what a woman is, but she wouldn't. This is why she said, well, I'm not a biologist. I can't pronounce on that. I'm not an expert. You don't have to be a biologist to know what a woman is. You don't have to be an expert to know what a woman is. So I remember it very well. And this was why it was so ridiculous that she, in a way, she did kind of fall into the trap by not answering the question. Because it was, as I say, so transparently obvious that she was contorting herself to avoid giving the answer that she knew would undercut the ideology on that side of the fence. So that was my take on it. Was there something about that more that you wanted to ask about?
Well, no, it was, it led to that film that Matt Walsh did, which was an outstanding thing, also terrifying to hear all these academics and legal and other professional people squirming to try to prove that there is no such thing as gender unless it's in your mind. The main thing was that she did answer the question that it's biology that determines.
That's what I'm saying. She didn't say that. She didn't say it's biology. She alluded to it by trying to deflect and say, well, I'm not a biologist. I can't say. So I see what you're saying. In other words, you're inferring that she was sort of conceding that the definition of a woman is biological at its root. But that was, I don't think she was even conceding that. She just sort of got caught in her clumsy answer. Well, I'm not a biologist. I don't think she intended to suggest that she believes that the definition of women is solely biological. I think it was just the result of her clumsiness in trying to deflect and get away from this question that she didn't want to answer. So I wouldn't read too much into that, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for expanding that. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for that. Who asked the question, Cyrus? Senator Blackburn, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Yep,
Senator Blackburn. Unreal. So, hey, Patrick, what's 2 + 2? Oh, you can't answer that because you're not a mathematician.
You know, that's true. Oh, you know what? I forgot. I learned that when I was growing up. It's 4.
That's right. And what's a woman?
A woman is a female of the species who conceives in her body when procreation takes place and gives birth to young and has the capacity not only to gestate and give birth, but also to nourish through mammary glands. There are other parts of the definition, but in terms of the biological aspect, that's a big part of it right there.
No, I just stumbled upon a tweet from this. I'm assuming this is a gay woman, and she's actually apologizing for she never knew it was going to go this far.
Oh, I remember this. So this one just recently popped up, I think. So is this the same one I'm thinking of where there is she's responding or reacting to a young, let's just say, lesbian, I think, who's on TikTok voicing her.
Very upset that people are misgendering her.
Misgendering. Okay. And so and then the lady, the lesbian lady that you're referring to, right, she's reacting to what she sees in this younger woman, right?
That's right. Yeah. And it's, okay, it's a quick, it's
yeah,
less than a minute.
Let's play it. All Let's right. play it. It is very interesting.
I don't understand what is so hard about correcting other people.
I'm so sorry I fought for gay rights. I'm so sorry for all the pain and suffering I went through. And had I known y'all were going to take it this far, I wish I could go back in time and not fight for gay rights and just live a nice, quiet, silent life on my own. We thought that's what we were fighting for, was just nice, quiet, fitting in, being just like everyone else. But I didn't know y'all were going to take it this far. I mean,
she looks very perplexed.
Wish I would have never done it.
Yeah, the regrets that come from this. Things that seem really good right now, or they're like, yeah, this is going to be great. You look back on it later with regret, like she does. I haven't seen any message like that from a lesbian woman like this one.
No, that was the first time I saw it, too. That's what it struck me. And then the guy who posted the video, he also wrote, to be fair, these people, I guess by these people he means, you know, the people that were fighting for gay rights back in the day, they were saying, if we let 2 men get married, then people will try to marry a goat. Or I guess that's people arguing against, right, you know, white, against her stance then. And he's saying nobody was saying the progression of gay rights will eventually lead to the expansion of the definition of gender, which will lead to the indoctrination of young people into an ideology that they exist on a gender spectrum and they are being victimized by anybody who doesn't believe that they are neither male nor female. So we have reached crazy town.
I remember, and I think this might be what you're alluding to, Cyrus. I remember Rick Santorum, who was a senator at the time, and he may even have been running for the nomination for the Republican presidential ticket. And in an interview, he brought this up, and he was roundly mocked for this. This is before Obergefell versus Hodges, the redefinition of marriage. And you know, of course, and by the way, young Thomas, please take a close look at line 6, please, and help me fix that issue, if you would do that for me, please, ASAP. I don't really want to continue with this conversation as long as, there we go, thank you. people are saying, what? What's going on? There is a child on hold, and I don't want to talk about this with a child on hold, so that's the reason for that. Problem solved. So Rick Santorum was at least one of the people and maybe the main person who brought this up, the slippery slope idea. If you redefine marriage, at some point it's going, and I'm paraphrasing what I recall, at some point it's going to not be, you know, just two men or two women, it opens the door to any other combination of weirdness that you can imagine. And he was roundly mocked for this. And now, I mean, what he said is true. And I think people at the time who thought clearly about this recognized it was true and it wasn't something that was unique to him. Other people had pointed out the same thing, but we're seeing it, and we have been seeing it for some time now, that the effort to change the law with regard to marriage, you can't actually change marriage. Marriage is, as Jesus said, a marriage between a man and a woman, one man and one woman. That's the paradigm that was given by God in the Garden of Eden. And if you don't believe in the Garden of Eden, that's fine. We'll just look at history through the lenses of secular observation, and you'll see it's always a man and a woman. So what about now? What about two men and a woman? What about polyamory? What about five dudes and a chicken? Why does it have to be even a human? Does it even have to be alive? What about an inanimate object? There are people who think they can get married to a car. See how crazy it's gotten? I'll be right back. No.